Welcome to The Lobbying Show, a podcast about the people in government relations, how they got into it, what their jobs entail, what works, and what doesn't. I'm your host, Jim O'Brien. All right, if it's Monday, must be time for another episode of The Lobbying Show. Today, we are talking to Chris Badgley. Chris is the CEO and Executive Director of ADSO, and ADSO, of course, acronym, if you're in Washington, D.C., have to have an acronym. And that is the Association for Dental Support Organizations. And what they do is they work, basically run the back office of a dental office. So the dentist and the dental hygienist can focus on dental care. They can take care of the real estate, human resources, leasing equipment, all that kind of stuff. So today we are going to sit down and talk to Chris and hear all about ADSO and the DSO model, and hear about his career and how he got into government relations and his prior jobs. So here is Chris. Hope you enjoy the episode. All right. Well, I'm sitting across back in Washington, D.C., and I'm sitting across from Chris Badgley. Chris is the CEO and the executive director of ASDO. It's Washington, D.C. There has to be an acronym. And so ASDO, which for people in the business probably
ADSO,
know.
ADSO.
Yeah. Oh, I have a little dyslexia kicking in.
That's okay.
ADSO,
yep.
Which stands for?
Association of Dental Support Organizations.
All right. Chris, welcome.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. So Chris, you have had a few different jobs, which we will get into, but I wanted to just start off by talking about in a lot of the roles that you've had to interact, you know, you've had issues come up in states, you've had to work with lobbyists, PR firms, grassroots, grass tops. Have you been active in all most states across the country and in the different hats that you've worn?
Yeah, I've visited every state capital at least once. Unfortunately, some more often than others.
What's your favorite?
Probably Sacramento, actually.
And why is that? The weather?
Well, I like the weather. And prior to term limits, it was a great place to be. I count Willie Brown as one of my mentors. And certainly when Willie was in power, he ran the assembly as has been portrayed. But it was a great learning experience because one of the things that he taught me early on when I first came to visit him, actually, was I was talking and lobbying him on my issue. And he was kind of paying attention, but all of a sudden he held up one piece of paper in one hand and the San Francisco Chronicle in the other. And of course it caused me to stop. And I said, Mr. Brown, I guess you're trying to make a point. And he goes, yeah. He goes, you got a great issue. He goes, but until you can affect my polls, which was in his one hand, or the op-ed page in the San Francisco Chronicle, I don't know how I can help you. So that was one of my first kicks in the teeth by a politician, but he did it in a very nice way.
And he was being honest.
He was being very honest.
And so term limits had a big change in California?
Term limits had a huge change in California. Now, quite often, leadership is chosen her freshman year. So because of term limits, in incoming freshmen not only can, but will and have been the Speaker of the Assembly for basically the length of their term. And it creates an interesting dynamic because most of the people coming in, they've not been to the Capitol before and worked it. So you've got somebody who can't hardly find a bathroom, but they're now Speaker of the Assembly.
So you can have freshman legislators be Speaker of the Assembly?
Yes, absolutely.
That's insane. Wow. I had no idea. Okay.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, for those of you out there that are listening that like term limits, it's not been a good thing.
And so let's start off with your current organization. Tell us about it. Tell us about your members and what you guys do.
Yeah, so the Association of Dental Support Organizations represents the businesses that support dentists. And the easiest way to think about this is that dentists are clinicians who practice in a patient's mouth. My members handle everything that occurs in the office outside the mouth. So HR, leasing and placing, buying real estate, IT, legal support, accounting support. They perform all the wraparound services to dental offices. Some of our members are very small and emerging. It's a growing market. It's about 7.4%, I think, according to the American Dental Association's last survey back in 2016 of total dental practices in the United States, but it's growing very quickly as two things occur. One, dentists come out of school saddled with a huge amount of debt that they have trouble then financing an office to open on their own. And the other thing is that the joke in the dental profession is that dentists spend half their career building a practice and then the other half trying to sell it. So in effect, our members help with affiliating with these offices, running the offices, and contractually work with the dentist and provide the dentist with an income stream. So it works out for everybody.
It's so interesting you say that because my dentist just did just that like 5 years ago, started bringing out partners with the whole point of selling it. And now I think he is retired and just that, just kind of the handoff occurred. Yeah. And you said 7%.
It's about 7.4% in 2016.
And what does that number represent? I'm sorry.
That's the number of dental practices in the United States that are supported by our members. So the other 90-some percent are still single proprietor, large group practice models, things of that nature.
Okay. And you see that 7% growing?
Yeah, it's growing at a rate of 12 to 20% a year. So it's going to hit a point at some point where it will be the majority of practices, I believe. Probably not in my career, but certainly that's the trajectory it's on.
And explain to me again, so what's the difference between a practice that uses that and a practice that doesn't?
If in a single proprietor dentist office, the dentist themselves contracts or hires an accounting firm. They hire somebody maybe to do their IT or they buy their own computers.
Okay.
They may have an office manager to do the hiring of either the front office people that do the scheduling and greet people as they come in or the back office people that process the insurance. They do that piecemeal. They do that a la carte. Basically what they hire our members to do is to provide that full menu of options so that all they have to do is concentrate on treating patients.
And your members do that full menu. They do everything
they
you
do
just
full
mentioned.
Menu. Absolutely.
And who are some of your bigger members that people might recognize?
Some of the members that people might recognize, Clear Choice is one of our members, Aspen Dental, Heartland Dental. Some companies actually brand the office. So Aspen Dental brands their office, PDS, which is Pacific Dental Services. Brands their offices, but for example, Heartland allows the affiliated offices to keep their brand because they believe that the local brand is very important. So it's Dr. Jones, and you may never know that Dr. Jones, the dentist, is actually
affiliated with Heartland. Okay. And does Heartland or Heartland type member, how do they help when the dentist goes to retire or sell the practice?
What they do is they help the dentist select either someone to take their place, or in some ways they, just let the dentist retire and then they find another dentist. They find another dentist to replace them, but the practice is almost always active. If the practice, of course, just like a single proprietor, if the practice isn't making money, maybe nobody comes in and takes over the practice. But generally, the practice model is that it's in a good location, good clientele, and it's just a transition. One of the examples that one of our members gave is it's kind of like leasing a car versus buying a car. If you're a sole proprietor, you're buying a car. You're getting a loan from a bank. You know, you're paying the bank. You're getting the assets over time. And in our practice model, it's like leasing a car. You know, there's a little cost up front. You know, you get a payment every month, but at the end of the lease, you walk away from the practice and the business retains the assets.
And what are some of the issues that you and your members are facing with state governments or federal government?
Right now, the largest issue for us is organized dentistry, the single practitioners. They don't like the DSO model coming into their area. Reason being, in some ways, we're kind of like the Walmart big box versus mom and pop retail. That sole practitioners, again, because they're doing everything on their own, they can't leverage having 500 offices nationwide to get a product, whether it's rubber gloves or whether it's, you know, the cotton padding that goes in your mouth or whether it's drill bits that are going to be used and replaced. our members can use the buying power that they have, having many offices, to drive the cost down, and single practitioners can't do that. So it's a little more difficult for them to compete. Some of the other things is, for our members, is the upgrading and updating modernization of the office. Our members can afford to buy a $500,000 3D scanner and put it in an office where a single practitioner with an associate or two may be sitting there going, I can't afford that. The bank's not going to give me any more money, you know, as a loan. So actually, they try to do things legislatively, since the practice of dentistry is regulated at the state level through the Board of Dental Examiners in the state, and it's often staffed and populated by single practice dentists in the state. So they use a regulatory authority to try to do some anti-competitive, antitrust activity to restrict free trade and restrict my members coming in into a location and competing.
And how do they do that? What are the laws or the regs look like that would restrict you?
Well, they attempt to, again, if you look at what the Board of Medical Examiners do, they're supposed to regulate the practice of dentistry. Mm-hmm. And a practice of dentistry generally is defined as what happens intraorally in a patient's mouth. Mm-hmm. Some boards of medical examiners, through legislation and their state medical association, are attempting to do is to regulate the business aspect. So they can say, who does the hiring, who does the firing, who does the accounting? And they attempt to regulate the non-clinical aspects of dentistry. And it's a really difficult fight that we're in on a state-by-state basis.
And how many states are you very active in right now? And
we're extremely active in one, and then we're fairly active in about 13 others.
Okay. And in your model, who owns the practice?
The dentist owns the practice. Mm-hmm. He contracts with my members. And again, it's like a lease. So the dentist really owns the practice, which in essence are the patient records. Mm-hmm. But they basically contract with our members to lease all the other services. Mm. So whether it's, the real estate, some of our members own real estate that then they support a practice on real estate that they own. Sometimes they go out and do the negotiation for the lease and the building and, you know, the cleaning and everything else.
Hmm. So there's real advantages to being using the DSO model.
Yes, definitely.
Kind of hard for you to probably articulate. Are there any disadvantages? What are the arguments against it? You know,
well, the arguments against it, again, that are
and
used.
I'm not talking about the people with sour grapes or whatever. I'm just talking about from a broad perspective.
I mean, the arguments that are used on the other side is that it's corporate dentistry. It's not local. That dentists are being told how to practice dentistry by somebody with green eye shades in a faraway land. But that's just not true. Again, the dentist in our practice model owns the practice, owns the patients, and they're totally independent to make the clinical decisions. Our members do not interfere with the clinical decision-making, but there might have been, and there may exist currently, bad actors that might be attempting to impose that type of model on the dentist that they support. But we, as an organization, have a very strict code of ethics, and none of that occurs in ADSO member practices. That's part of what we just say is not, you know, mm-hmm. tolerated. Mm-hmm. Because again, the dentist is the one who went to dental school, is making the clinical decisions, not somebody, you know, Southern California for a practice in Idaho.
And when did the DSO business model, when did it really begin? How did it begin?
It really began about 20, 25 years ago, roughly. So it's been in existence a long time, but the founding fathers of the industry were generally dentists themselves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they were practicing dentistry. They were looking at all the stuff that they were doing once they were done seeing patients. They're doing a bookkeeping. They're you know, hiring accountants. They're talking to lawyers about contract law for their real estate, et cetera, et cetera. So some of these gentlemen said, you know what? I want to expand. I want to have more than one practice. So they started building out their practices. And roughly what I'm told, I've been in the industry a fairly short period of time, but once you get to a critical mass of about five practices and you've got the clinicians, including dental hygienists, by the way, not just dentists, but dental hygienists and dental technicians. Once you reach that point, you've almost got to go into the practice model where you concentrate on the business aspects separate from the clinical aspects. You can no longer, as a person managing 3 to 5 practices, again, once you're expanding beyond that, going, you know what, I can keep doing this in practice dentistry. So these gentlemen made the decision, look, we think that there's a business model here. We can create this DSO practice model, and we'll reach out to dentists and start affiliating with dentists. And that's what they did. They went from office to office. And rather than taking over the office and getting the bank to finance the takeover in office, they're going, look, we can provide this service for a fee. Here's how it's structured. What do you think? And that's how it grew.
So your member companies must have, I can't imagine the different human resources, legal, real estate. I mean, it must be just fascinating companies with all the different expertise.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, it really is a big business operation. And even as those businesses are growing, there's, you know, break points too, you know, like from 20, when you're at 25 and you're going to 50, you're going to double to 50. You know, how do you increase your call center that's making the appointments for all the offices in the U.S.? It's just fascinating. I've toured several of our members and they all have their way of doing business and their own culture, but it is amazing.
Well, you seem like you like what you do.
Yeah, I love what I do.
And prior to this, you were where?
I spent 7 years prior to coming here at the U.S. affiliate of a Japanese pharmaceutical company. I've been in the pharmaceutical industry for over 30 years. I took a short break about 8 months in the tech industry, but I was in the pharmaceutical industry at the trade association when Medicare Part D passed in 2004. And then I was also intimately involved and helped run the campaign that the pharmaceutical industry had to support the passage of the Affordable Care Act in 2009 and then 2010 when it was signed by President Obama.
And what was that work like, getting that passed?
That was crazy. I mean, that was both the high point and low point of my career. It was everything that you have to do in a national campaign from, as you had said early on, grass tops, grassroots, direct lobbying, indirect lobbying. It was just crazy. And it was a 24/7, 365 campaign until it was done.
And how long did the campaign last?
We actually started the prep work, and I mean preliminary prep work, in September, October of 2008, even before Obama was elected.
Wow.
Because the pharmaceutical industry made a decision that candidate Obama was most likely going to be elected president, and what would healthcare reform look like, since that was a major part of what he was, you know, proposing at the time, what that might look like, where the pharmaceutical industry might fit in, and how could we become a part of that? So the groundwork, the thought process in terms of the policy was set in the late 2008 before even election was held. And then it really ramped up when President Obama came in and again started pulling together his staff and pulling together what the policy would look like, which became the Affordable Care Act. And so we had to do the prep work for that. And then we were intimately involved going forward from there.
And then you were at the industry association for a number of years prior to being with the pharmaceutical company?
Yes. So I was with a pharmaceutical company early in my career. The first 19 years I was with Wyeth, which is now part of the greater Pfizer.
Okay.
I went to the trade association in 1999. I was there as head of state government affairs for 9 years. And then the last year and a half I was there was involved in the campaign to support the passage of the Affordable Care Act.
Wow. And how is it different working for one pharmaceutical company versus working for the trade association? And actually, what's it like working for one company as opposed to a trade association? I'm not talking pharmaceutical.
Yeah, and that actually has a bearing on my interactions now with my members of my current position. But clearly in a company that's been around for a long time and very established, and we had, at the time I was at Wyeth, we had 81,000 employees worldwide. It was a huge company. I can't imagine how many Pfizer has worldwide, but it's got to be north of 81. But there's clearly defined chain of command in terms of who you get your orders from, for lack of a better term, your direction from, and then what resources you might have within the organization to implement and execute against that. In a trade association, you've got to listen to a lot of voices. At Pharma, we had members as small as the company that I came from before I came to ADSO, and that was at the time like $1.9 billion in annualized revenue in the U.S. On the, you know, Pfizer side, I can't even imagine what Pfizer's is. It's like huge. It's hundreds of billions. So you've got to look and listen to all those members, synthesize all the voices, and look out after everybody's interests, knowing that they're competitors and they're trying to use the trade association in some ways to promote their public policy that they have in mind that actually might not benefit all the members, but would certainly benefit them. So you've got to be able to dance that dance. And actually, that's one of the fun things about working in a trade association in my mind.
Well, and you must have been pretty good at it.
I survived.
Well, you were there 10 years. You did better than survive. I can't imagine synthesizing those different opinions. That has got to be, I mean, herding cats doesn't even probably begin to describe it.
Yeah.
And I'm not even talking about your, I'm just talking about any trade association.
Yeah.
You know, there's very different sizes of companies, different philosophies, different approach.
Yeah.
And you bring those together and try to come up with a policy that they all agree with.
Yeah.
Not easy.
Well, and it's tough. And depending on the bylaws of the organization, some organizations go, it's got to be 100% consensus, which in some ways is a nightmare, right? Because you have 30 people in a room. How are you going to engineer that agreement? It gets very difficult. If you're in where it's a majority or it's a supermajority, it's a little easier. And even within pharma that did, at least while I was there, most everything by consensus, there was a point at the board level where if there was not, if consensus could not be reached, it was a supermajority of, you know, 75% of the voting membership. It is tough to drive consensus. It's a lot of work, and you have to have a lot of lead time. You've got to really know and understand both their business models and how the policy might affect them. And then it's like any compromise or any consensus, right? Sometimes everybody gets a haircut. Nobody really likes what happened, but they can accept what happened and know it's not going to hurt them.
Right. And then you probably have the case where something is passing in a state that a few members, as you just said, may be fine with and other members are not. And again, as a trade association rep, how do you weigh in on that? And it's not easy.
Yeah. Well, again, during the process, one of the things that I've prided myself on in my career, and I still do to this day, is to have an open, transparent process where everybody knows what's going on, where everybody knows what we as their trade association is thinking and how we see the line of sight to the end product, whatever it might be, knowing again that we may have to take a haircut in some way, but what that haircut looks like and are we getting a haircut or are we getting scalped? I mean, that becomes a real differentiator, right?
What did you do prior to being in government relations?
I started my career at Wyeth in pharmaceutical sales. So I carried a bag, went to doctor's offices, came up through sales management and found my way into marketing. But there was a sidestep while I was in both sales, personal sales, and then sales management. And that's what actually brought me into government affairs. If you look at healthcare is probably, and pharmaceuticals, probably the most regulated, one of the most regulated industries in the United States. And I saw the effect that government, whether it be federal government or state government, was having on my ability to go into an individual doctor's office and sell a product. So I actually, in my territory, had two state capitals in my territory to begin with. I had Springfield, Illinois, and Jeff City, Missouri. And then when I became a sales manager, because I had Jeff City, Missouri, I was given that assignment. My district changed. I was given that assignment. I picked up Topeka, Kansas. But because of the impact that state government was having on the ability of first me individually and then my sales rep to sell product, I got more involved in how does this thing work? And how do these laws that are impacting me and regulations impacting me, how can I have an impact on them? And so I kind of backed into government affairs. And one day, a friend of mine called from our headquarters, Wyeth headquarters, at the time in Radnor, Pennsylvania, and said, you know, we're thinking of putting together a government affairs group, and we know that you've been poking around in this. You want to come in and help set it up? And I said, sure. So that's how I actually got into government affairs.
Wow.
I kind of backed into it. I was on a marketing path, and a friend of mine just called and said, the company really knows nothing about government affairs. You've been dinking around with it. You want to come in and do it. I said, sure.
So you left sales management and jumped into government affairs and
created the government.
Started the office.
And created the government affairs department at Wyeth at the time.
Wow. Getting back to the business is kind of what works, what doesn't. What have you learned that does not work? What have you learned that can really hurt you, whether it's trying to pass or stop something?
I think that one of the underpinnings that has really stuck with me is that I work for my association. I represent my association. And although I have my personal politics, you can't let, especially if you come to government affairs from a staff position, from a known political party, you can't really let your own personal politics get in the way of achieving what you need to on behalf of your client, in my case, an association. So again, Willie Brown was a big mentor to me in California, but conversely, I had some mentors on the Republican side as well in deep red Republican states. And it really is, again, the eye that you can't ever lose sight of is the eye looking from state to state, issue to issue. What are the political dynamics in that state? And what do I have to either support or overcome to achieve my goal in that state? And you can't let personal politics get in the way ever, ever, ever. That's the first thing.
Have you stayed in touch with Willie Brown?
Yeah, I haven't talked to him in about a year, but I get out to San Francisco on occasion, and I always try to look him up. He and I really love Italian food, and North Beach Restaurant in North Beach area, San Francisco, is one of our favorite places to go.
Yeah, well, he is a legend in politics and in California politics, obviously. So you do a lot of riding outside?
Yes, I do cycling.
Outdoors?
Yes, outdoors. I live in Reston, Virginia, and there's the Old Dominion Trail that goes from Leesburg. I can get on my bike in Reston, and I can literally, which I haven't done though, pedal to my office in Crystal City.
Oh, wow.
Which is 20-some-odd miles.
The new home of Amazon H2Q.
Yes.
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 And you also play the guitar.
I play electric guitar. I have since I've been 14. And I hate to say it, I'm 64 now, and my ears are still show it because they're ringing today.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I have tinnitus, but that's because I played loud guitar for a long time.
Well, Chris, this has been great. Thank you for coming in. Is there anything else you want to add?
No. Good luck to everybody who listens to podcasts. This is a great way to have a career, and I continue to do it for as long as I'm healthy. So good luck to everybody.
Well, good. Well, thank you for coming in.
Thanks.
All right.
All right. Well, that was great. Great to talk to Chris. I really liked him. And he's a good friend of Jen Stowe. And we were happy to sit down with Chris and learn about all that he does and what he's done in his career. So if you haven't already, you can subscribe to our podcast wherever it is that you listen to your podcast, on Apple or Spotify. Spotify is a great new platform for podcasts. They are jumping into the space in a big way. We are big supporters of Spotify and Apple, of course, and Google. They are all in the podcast space. So you can subscribe there, and you can follow us on Twitter, at The Lobbying Show. You can sign up for the Monday morning email, the Monday morning coffee with The Lobbying Show, at our website, thelobbyingshow.com. You can also find us, of course, on Facebook and Instagram. So everyone, hope you enjoyed the show. Have a great week. See you next Monday.